My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
In life and recovery, every day is a little different. Embrace the good days, the not so good days, and the challenges, and acknowledge how you overcame them. Find the path to recovery that works for you. Learn more at cdc.gov/stopoverdose.
I'm John Oran, Puck's sports correspondent, and I have a new podcast called The Varsity, where I will take you inside the executive suites and owner's boxes that run the entire sports business. Twice a week, I will bring on the smartest people I know to break down the hottest topics in sports media and give you a window into the inside conversations that are happening throughout sports media. So be sure to follow and listen to The Varsity Podcast, available now on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Deceptively Fast Podcast. I am Seth Payne. I'm going to have my buddy Drew Hodgson with me today. We both played for the Houston Texans. We were teammates long ago, and I try to convince him today that it's okay. There's nothing to be ashamed of in rejoicing, gloating even over the fact that the Texans are definitely 100% not the worst team in the NFL. Baby steps, baby. Baby steps. Hey, if you like the podcast, where we also get into a whole lot of other stuff, health-related, career-related, all that kind of stuff. Today we talk about the 8 reasons that French people don't get fat while Americans, we tend to be a portly bunch. Go ahead and subscribe, and also leave a 5-star review if you really, really like it. Awesome. Here we go. All right, Drew, we did it. The Texans, I'll say we, because after victories, I still refer to the team as we.
exactly.
We proved to the world, the entire world was watching, and we proved that we're not the worst team in the league. And that's reason for celebration, is it not? Tell me I'm pathetic. I don't care. Everybody was convinced that the Texans wouldn't win a game this year, that they were so awful, because somehow all the off-field drama was going to filter out. I'm sitting here proudly proclaiming we're number 27, at least 27th or 28th.
Yeah, we are not in the bottom 5 teams for sure. Like, and it's definitely we. I think like we've over the last year and a half, we've earned the right to celebrate every possible victory. So, I'll take it.
It's hard for me because I played for the Jaguars and the Texans, but because I broadcast in Houston, obviously, and because my best, frankly, I'm a selfish person. My best personal performances were with the Texans, so I think that's how I decided to become a Texan for life. Even though the teams were better with the Jaguars, it's hard for me to watch the Jaguars who were so excited about Urban Meyer. Maybe Oof. Have to come to the realization that wow. Urban Meyer might have been the least prepared. His team might have been the least prepared team in the NFL on Sunday.
You know, I've seen a lot of that, and I don't get me wrong. I mean, the performance speaks for itself, but I still just feel like this is the first game of a brand new coach with a rookie quarterback and a team that clearly needed to go through a lot of changes anyway. So I'm not saying that they're going to be good.
But, yeah, they got the number one pick for a reason. That's what you always have to remember. Yeah. And it's not as simple as just sprinkling some pixie dust on it. And
right.
Trevor Lawrence has a great arm, so he's going to be good. That is a very valid point. And I think sometimes if you look at some of the things that went wrong in the game, those are things that a quarterback usually maybe can get right. Some of the illegal formations. Well, 2 of the illegal formations were just an offensive lineman lining up too deep.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, there were a lot of stories about, boy, I wonder if Urban Meyer is going to quit already.
Yeah.
And I was just like, what are we doing? This is a very competitive guy. And I'm not saying that he's going to stick it out for 5 years.
But he always quits.
We're one game in. So, settle down, everybody.
He quits after winning national championships.
He doesn't quit after going 0-1. That's a little aggressive.
Like, I'm pretty good at working up animosity for people, and I can't even do it with Urban Meyer, like there's a certain amount of hypocrisy when any kind when any football coach just quits on a team.
Yeah.
But I think with him, there are at least some of the time valid health concerns. And it is after he won a national championship in both Florida and Ohio State. It's not like you can point to him and say, well, you left all this work unfinished. Yeah,
sure.
But, I mean, you left when things got really tough, but you did do what you got hired to go there and do.
Yeah, he didn't exactly, you know, give up in the midst of the program being a complete debacle. I mean, you can kind of, yeah, no, not at all. Or like a Saban when he was in the NFL and just kind of got ran out and never tried to go back. I mean, it's a little premature to speculate when it comes to, you know, the demise of Urban Meyer. I think I the same thing with Trevor Lawrence. I mean, I felt like I was living on a lonely island watching Trevor Lawrence. I understand he made some bad throws. It's pretty obvious. It was his very first game. I mean, the guy looked like he has a ton of talent to me. So I guess it's TBD on him.
He really does. Now, you noticed this early on in before the numbers really bore it out, you'd noticed, hey, he's got just no cool, right? Like he's got no chill. There was there was no touch. Early on, there were some drops by receivers and running backs, but he was partially involved with that. He was just rifling stuff as hard and as fast as he could. And it looked like he understood that he had to be more concerned about interceptions in the NFL, but he was he was so nervous about that's when he ended up just flinging it as hard as he could and as inaccurately as he could. There's one throw out to James Robinson, a short pass.
Oh yeah.
Throw to the running back. It was way too hot for a running back to handle. It was the kind of stuff that like maybe Brady would do it if somebody was closing in on the running back, but he was wide open and he just threw it way too hard. So I think once he settles down a little bit, it'll be a lot better.
It was all the familiar symptoms of a rookie quarterback. I mean, just trying to force stuff that no chance his guys are going to be the only ones out there trying to make a play on the ball, no touch on the ball, and thinking that he was going to outrun defenders. That's just not going to be a thing for him. It's not going to happen. The bigger concern for all those guys, the same guys that come out of Alabama at quarterback to me, is that they haven't really experienced any hardship relative to having to bounce back from losses. He's lost two games. He's never gone through stretches of, you know, an abysmal, you know, four-game losing stretch and having to figure out how to turn it around, let alone two seasons.
He's never lost a regular season game in his entire high school, college career.
Oh, yeah. That to me is maybe this is a weird take, but I feel like that is a huge concern.
No. It is. I think it's really fair when you look at guys like Cam Newton or otherwise sometimes. And you know this, you played with guys sometimes that especially in the guys that went to like national championship caliber or like top 25 high schools. Those kids like De La Salle or some of those places, these blue blood high school programs where they just don't lose. They go years upon years of being undefeated. Sometimes those kids get to college and they lose games and it's like their mind is completely blown. They start freaking out, like screaming at teammates and everything because they just don't know. If I were going to judge Trevor Lawrence's body language, it didn't look like he was freaking out whatsoever. It looked like he handled it pretty well.
I agree. Yeah, that's why I'm not exactly. If I were to be worried, it would be much more about what's going on between his ears over the entire season or the next two seasons if they end up being really terrible. I mean, that's the kind of thing that can be lasting. But otherwise, I think I'll be fine. It's the same thing, man. Those guys that come from like blue blood programs.
Yeah.
That you're not tough if you make it through all the way to the NFL never having lost. That's not the definition of toughness.
That's not learning, an example. Right. There's almost no mental toughness without experience in some level of failure.
That's easy. Yeah. I can do that all day. That's not hard at all. Try to go 2-14 and then come back and tell everybody how awesome you are. Hard.
You're down at the dojo fighting 12-year-olds and just basking in all the mental toughness. I'm so tough.
Man, I can't believe how resilient I am. I am so resilient.
You know what's crazy? Okay, do you know who Dan Gable is?
I don't.
Dan Gable was a wrestler and then the head wrestling coach at Iowa for a long, long time.
Okay.
And just one of the greatest wrestlers of all time, one of the greatest wrestling coaches of all time. But he had a chance to go undefeated in college, never lose a single match. And he ended up losing. I believe it was his senior year, his final match in the finals. He lost. And it's crazy. You'd read articles about him, you know, 30, 40 years later, he still talks about that loss as one of the defining moments of his life, the thing that kept driving him. And I don't know if he would have gone into coaching. I imagine he would have, but maybe he wouldn't have been as driven. He was like a unique driven individual anyway. But that's the one guy I can think of who was so hardcore that I don't know if he probably would have been just fine without ever having losing. He might have been the same guy, but it definitely followed him the rest of his life. Like it probably maybe in some way made him more human. Maybe he could understand his other rest. I bet it made him a better coach because at least he understood the sting of losing.
Absolutely.
He used to talk about how much it ate him up inside to watch his guys lose. And I think because he had that feeling with him, but that's an individual sport too. For a team sport, there's something to being able to maintain that composure when you're looked at as a team leader and things are not going well around you. That's a learned trait. And some guys just don't have to learn it.
It is. That's exactly right. There's no experience like that other than actually having gone through it.
Yeah. And then in the NFL, there's just nothing. Like you're not going to go undefeated. Maybe you do once in an entire career. But after that, that's not, like you're going to lose games and you're going to have a hardship. And sometimes your team's going to look like it sucks. What about, okay, Tyrod Taylor, however, he says he doesn't care how you pronounce it. Tyrod Taylor, I thought, had a pretty good game. And I think above and beyond the statistics, a lot of his big time throws came when the offensive line had some really bad snaps. Like two of his downfield throws to Brandon Cooks were where the offensive line was getting trucked on like simple D-line games. And I feel like he won't get a lot of credit for it because it was the Texans versus the Jaguars. And even though it was a really good offensive output, it just wasn't a glittering box score for him. I thought that was a really well-played game by Tyrod Taylor.
I think so too. I mean, it's all about expectations, right? So if that's Deshaun Watson, that looks like a pretty middling to above average performance by Deshaun Watson, I think, like for the most part, because guys were relatively open. They made plays downfield, but you expect that from him. I don't think the expectations were that he was going to do that. So, you know, he benefits from that, but he played well. And also, you know, I mean, you and I text about it, the performance of the offensive line, and when they don't play well, I'm a pretty tough critic. And in that case, I mean, on those plays, yeah, it looked bad, but overall they played pretty well. They gave him a lot of time throughout the game. He just showed up on the plays that looked like they were going to be a debacle.
That's where
difference.
It ended up being a really good overall offensive performance because of that. I think a lot of people wondered whether he still had the ability to move, and you kind of forget just what he was when he was in Buffalo, but he's 32 years old now. And 32 is not old. The only thing you have to worry about with a 32 year old versus a 25 year old is whether he can be as durable when he gets hit. So I was really pleasantly surprised by how much he was able to create on the run and then throw downfield. And part of that too is that he's got Brandon Cooks. I mean, Brandon Cooks is a really good deep threat, especially if it's on an extended play where he can create some space and separation and move a little bit out of sync with what the defense is expecting.
But he looked really confident. I mean, he looked like a guy who knew where everybody was supposed to be, when they were going to be there. He knew exactly how to manage the offense. He looked very secure in what they were doing. Like, to me, and that extends beyond just what he was doing at quarterback. I mean, the coaching staff looked really confident. They weren't taking ridiculous timeouts. They weren't making terrible decisions when they were, you know, backed up. Not that they had those situations, but just, you know, kind of the special moments in the game where you used to get so, you were just so used to seeing Bill O'Brien do something utterly ridiculous.
It felt like decisions were made with like fists clenched, like shoulders hunched up to the ears, the most extreme amount of tension you could have. 18 Red Bulls at halftime, like whatever it took to make things as hard and difficult as possible. I think that was a common refrain amongst people, was that even when the Texans had good offensive outputs in previous years, it never felt methodical and steady. It never felt integrated. Like it just didn't feel as dominant perhaps as this. And Sean Pendergast he compiled the stats. He just went through basically all the third downs. Like, there were very few third and longs in this game. They really did a good job of just moving the sticks.
Yeah.
Making it third and manageable. You know, there were several third and shorts to where they had some options between the run and the pass. So I was very pleased with it. This week they play the Browns, and that'll be a whole different scenario. Cause I think that the Browns, with between Baker Mayfield and his receivers, they're going to be able to exploit some of the holes that we saw in that defense. Like,
yeah,
the classic holes in zone coverage were definitely there. And with smarter and better receivers and a better quarterback, it'll be interesting to see exactly how it plays out. I don't think the Texans are going to get completely obliterated or gashed or anything. It's a much higher level of difficulty this week.
Yeah, you didn't see any of the familiar symptoms of just a completely embarrassing team that was so often popping up in the past. So yeah, it was good. It was a good product.
And I don't really like piling on Bill O'Brien. It comes up from time to time, because part of the problem with Bill O'Brien was that he shouldn't have been a general manager, you know. Right. And I don't think he actually wanted to be a general manager, except for the fact that he didn't seem to get along with any general managers. He didn't want to be, you know, he's somebody that maybe after his third or fourth divorce realizes, like, I'm just not the marrying type. I think that's what O'Brien's gonna, I think that's why he's going to end up a college coach. I think he's realized he's not the marrying type when it comes to general managers. And he'll be a good employee to Nick Saban for a year or two, but then he can go off and he can be a college head coach where there is no salary cap. Everybody gets paid the same amount. And he can recruit and just be in charge without having to deal with the general manager or anything. And he'll probably be really good at it.
Right. I think you more or less nailed it. I mean, he clearly knows football. He can make it work at the college level.
So, speaking of Bill O'Brien, this article in The Athletic by Mike Sando pointed out that Brian Flores now has a winning record as a head coach versus his former boss, Bill Belichick. He's 3-2. Against Bill Belichick. It kind of shocked me when I saw that they had played that many times, and you remember, oh yeah, they're in the AFC East. No other former coach has done that. Now, I feel like there should be a little bit of an asterisk there, because a lot of these guys just weren't successful head coaches in general. But for way of illustration, Nick Saban was 2-2. Romeo Crennel was 1-1. Eric Mangini was 3-4. Bill O'Brien, who might arguably be the NFL head coach out of those guys, is 1-4 against Bill Belichick. I honestly, my first thought when I see that is that those are better records than I thought they would be versus Bill Belichick.
I think you're right. I was a little surprised too. I actually thought it would be even more skewed than it was.
I thought that Belichick would have really just taken these guys to the woodshed. Some of those guys, you know, Romeo Crennel his overall head coaching record is not 500. I don't know what it is, but I know it's not 500. So for him to be 1-1 versus Belichick is a little bit surprising. Mangini had a couple good years, or one good year, but I thought that Belichick for sure would have like known all of Eric Mangini's flaws and whatnot.
But that's the thing though, is that when you feel like that, that's just what shocks me, is that if you're coming out of that kind of consistent, I mean, say what you want about New England, but like, they have an ethos and a system.
Yeah.
So you're thinking, if you leave there as a guy, as a several guys getting shots to manage entire teams and franchises, that they're going to have the capability to dismantle a franchise if they know it from the inside. Mm-hmm. One of those guys is going to be able to consistently do it. I mean, that's what you think, if that's how they're being schooled and trained by a mentor like that. And none of them do. I'm only one of them have a winning record against them, which to me is weird.
They're trying to beat him at his own game. They're taking all those game planning elements and everything. And I think, and maybe that's what with Belichick is, as poorly as the Patriots have drafted at times in Belichick's regime, especially over the last decade or so, I do think he still has a knack for identifying personnel, maybe on the pro personnel side of things, like where guys' weaknesses are, where their strengths are, all of that. And that's what he's all about, is exploiting weaknesses, minimizing the damage that your strengths can do. And I think he does a really good job. The one exception is Mike Vrabel's not on that coaching tree, but Vrabel's had some good performances versus Belichick. I don't know what his overall record is, but he's flat out embarrassed him a couple of years ago. And I wonder if Vrabel Greg Rosenthal from the NFL.com, who's a Patriots fan, said that there's something about that game plan offense and that method of preparing that every now and then you just your numbers come up, or you guess right, or you guess right. But sometimes you just guess right. And there's times where maybe Vrabel has just figured out exactly what the elixir is to beating Belichick that day. So I kind of put Vrabel on the Belichick coaching tree only because I know that Vrabel always wanted to be a coach. So when he was a player, he was taking notes on Bill Belichick's style, you know? So he didn't work for him directly, but Vrabel's actually in Urban Meyer's coaching tree.
I totally agree though. I mean, it's like, you kind of just by default have to put him in the coaching tree is what it feels like. It just feels like that's what the case is. But I mean, beyond that, it's been surprising that of all the guys that have come out of that tree and everything else, that it hasn't become more prevalent that people go with that weird matchup style. People don't really, like, you know what it's like. A lot of coaches, it's not a matchup league, like in the NBA or in other, it's just not really. I mean, they try to do things like, it's a generic, hey, we're going to match up running back up with a middle linebacker. And we're going to, but it's not really as, they don't get as, you know, in the minutia as Belichick has figured out how to do.
I think that what happens is the difference with Belichick and Tom Brady compared to a lot of people is their ability to adjust within the game.
Right.
That once you go into a game with a game plan, and sometimes you have to change it immediately. Like, you realize, okay, this isn't going to work today, or they've got the right answer for it. So then you have to go to plan B, plan C. And you'll see that. That's why so many times in New England, teams would do really well for the first 2.5 quarters.
Yeah.
The Patriots, maybe sometimes the first 3 quarters, but Belichick looks at those first 3 quarters as just a prelude to the actual game. And they're just probing you. That's why that's why the whole notion of keeping Brady off the field really isn't as much about minimizing his, you know, number of drives, right? It's minimizing his opportunities to probe your defense and to figure out what's working. Cause it's the worst. I never played against Brady when he was at his apex, but like Peyton Manning was the same way, where you'd get into midway through the third quarter or like sometimes early in the fourth quarter. And maybe you had a really good game plan going. And then all of a sudden you realize like, oh crap, he knows everything. Like, he's just, that's it. Oh,
yeah,
we're screwed. And he's figured out exactly when your safety is showing his hand or whatever it might be. And then it would just take over. And I think that's just where that's where some guys can do it and some guys can't. And very few guys can figure it out within the game the way that Belichick can.
Spot on. Totally agree.
So what was the other game? Were there any other games that stuck out to you this weekend?
I found myself being more engaged in this first week than I have in a long time. I mean, I kind of felt like I got so used to seeing teams just looking, understandably, and as always, really rusty. And it's not that teams didn't look rusty, but there were just a lot of really compelling, interesting games. I mean, you could say what you want about, you know, Green Bay looking terrible. To be honest with you, I didn't find that as surprising as maybe other people did. It kind of tracks to me. Uh-huh. But top to bottom, the NFC West obviously dominated. It's always fun to kind of see, in my opinion, to see the Cardinals just look good.
The Cardinals, well, you know, this kind of goes back to Urban Meyer, because I think Cliff Kingsbury started off pretty hot and had some success, but then it seemed like the league caught up to him. And then last year, people were starting to wonder whether Cliff Kingsbury should even be in the NFL, or does he know what he's doing? And somehow, because some quarterbacks have had success early on, people have completely forgotten that a young quarterback limits what you can do as an offensive coordinator. And you know what the big thing is now? This is driving me insane, Drew, is people realize and understand that, oh, wow, pre-snap motion helps a lot.
Yeah.
But they act like all you have to do is do pre-snap motion, and that it's simple to do pre-snap motion. It is a pain in the ass to do pre-snap motion frequently and do it without making mental errors, without tipping your hand to the defense. Like, it's not so simple just to do a bunch of pre-snap motion. I can remember sitting next to Kyle Brady every day in team meetings. This is back in dinosaur days, but we used a lot of tight end shifts and a lot of tight end motion. And Kyle Brady's a smart guy, but he'd have like four mental errors a game. And we'd have to sit there because Coughlin would read out the mental errors every day in practice. And it's kind of embarrassing. You know, when you get a mental error, you feel kind of like a dullard. And every day it'd be Kyle Brady, three mental errors, unacceptable. And Kyle would just sit there like, I know.
Dumb as ever, Kyle. Yeah, consistently dumb.
But it's just, it's not easy. I like all these things that look simple when you're watching the all 22 or when you're drawn up on a whiteboard. The problem is that they have to be done in the matter of 7 or 8 seconds on the field. And then you have to adjust to what the defense does. As you're in motion, you have to figure out how did the defense adjust to it? Not just the quarterback, but the receivers and everybody else. And how does that change my blocking assignments? Does the defense change? So I think that people were kind of piling on Cliff Kingsbury for his offense being too simplistic. And then all of a sudden you come out and you say, oh, wow, when Kyler Murray has an extra receiving option and an extra year of experience in the league, all of a sudden he looks like he's good for four passing touchdowns and a rushing touchdown in a game.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, there's obviously a ton of talent there. I mean, I think that's pretty evident relative to even some of the other teams that have a lot of talent. But man, you just nailed it. That so many teams got away from what used to be perceived to just sort of like the basics in trying to identify what a coverage is, what they're doing on defense by just moving guys around a little bit. But then it just became so vogue to always be in gun and then to always be in some kind of version of like a hurry up. So teams didn't really want to do it. They'd prefer to keep defenses honest and where they are and not do it. And that completely kind of, it just stopped happening. And so now teams are kind of starting to do it again. It's just, it goes with the trends of how the NFL flows. I love it. It's fun to see how it's changing.
You know, the other thing that's annoying me about the way people talk about strategy and analytics and stuff was Tyrann Mathieu a couple of weeks ago tweeted out something to the effect of, hey, you know, players should embrace analytics. It really helps you. It gives you an advantage, all this. And people were psyched about it, especially a lot of the writers that I follow that are really smart guys and everything. But I would see all these responses like, yeah, you know what? I bet he's doing. I bet he's looking at formations and figuring out what the tendencies are based on formations and down and distance. I'm like, yeah, they've been doing that for 50 years in the NFL. Yeah. Yes,
exactly.
That's not what he's talking about. When it comes to analytics, it's the way more advanced stuff. And they're doing some really cool stuff. But that's why it's funny that I think even the people that are pro analytics and anti analytics don't actually understand which analytics they're using in the NFL. That stuff, that's Stone Age stuff when it comes to down and distance tendencies and tendencies by formation. It's gotten a lot more advanced than that.
Well, and it's I think you're exactly right. I mean, you and I used to get, especially on defense too. I mean, how often would you get the percentages broken down by offensive formation for every single thing? It's been that way forever. I think now is, you know, you see like third party companies, they're trying to do everything they can to package it differently. It's the same thing. Not on a piece of paper that's been stapled, you know.
You know what though? It's the same thing. It's the same concept, except now it's in the hands of professionals. Because I had enough times, like, and Vic Fangio was really bright. He was never one of these guys that I'm about to talk about. But there were times where, you know, Vic, like going way back, used to break down tendencies by hand, like with a hand calculator. He said computers came along and it kind of wiped away a huge advantage he had back when he was with the New Jersey Generals.
Yeah, he was like punching in an old like CPA's calculator and there's like a reel of paper just like spewing it out.
Yeah. So he said when computers came along, it kind of leveled the playing field because it wasn't so laborious to do everything that he'd been doing. So it wasn't Vic, but I had enough times where I'd be sitting in a meeting and a coach would say, hey, in this down and distance and situation, they're 75% run. And I'd be like, they've been in that situation four times, coach. Like, this isn't not. Yeah, I think I talked to you about this earlier in one of our earlier podcasts. So now you have actual statisticians that understand sample size and understand separating the noise, the signal from the noise and all that stuff. So I think that part's really good. And they have all this biometric data that probably gives a better indicator of just like how people are operating and what they're doing and just, you know, what their splits are in different circumstances. So when you start being able to break down, okay, when they're in this formation, but the O-line has wide splits versus, that's, I think there's more real stuff now, but then the offense also has you know, access to scouting their own selves too. And it, yep. So that the cat and mouse game continues. It's a flirtation, if anything. So I don't have any.
Love that.
I don't have any. I don't have any listicles from you from any of these like top 10 ways to score chicks or anything this week.
Yeah, you didn't add that to the archive of all the times I send you ways to score chicks.
I'm going to click on, I still pay $5 a month for the Medium Daily Digest just because they publish articles that sometimes seem like easy, fun stuff to talk about. So here we go. You ready?
Always.
It says 8 reasons why the French do not get fat from the perspective of a half French Brit. So, and actually,
so specific.
I was thinking about this the other day because remember the whole French paradox thing when they couldn't figure out why French people don't get heart disease, even though they eat a boatload of fat. And it couldn't possibly be. Nobody could say like, well, could it possibly be that saturated fat on its own isn't that bad for you? No. That can't possibly be it. We've had decades of pushing that down people's throat, quite literally, that no, saturated fat is.
How else are we supposed to move all this high fructose corn syrup if we don't have something else to be our scapegoat? We need a straw man to move all this shit in the U.S.
Kids, there was a point where they started recommending that you drink like 3 bottles of red wine a day, because that must be why the French aren't.
Exactly.
That's one of my favorite things.
I also need to make sure that this isn't just like a cartoon of a French person that we're basing it on. And then the actual French diet. I don't know. It's like a guy like in a, you know, black and white horizontal striped tee, smoking a cig and crushing baguettes daily.
Oh, okay. Here's a good one though. And this is more of an approach to life. This isn't like some quick little, hey, here's 8 little tips to make you look as sexy as a Frenchman. It's okay. No deprivation means no binging. That's number one. You'll rarely hear of a French person being on a diet, not in a way that would involve cutting out an entire food group. So they eat. I think it's, I think what they're getting at is that they eat frequently and they indulge, but they tend to not to, they're eating rich foods that fill you up and whatnot, but they're not binging the way that, that you or I might as a matter of habit.
Yeah, no, I don't think any French people are binging the way that you and I are capable.
Okay. So, number two, now this is enough for this already. I'm falling off of this French plan. Number two, no snacking. She says, this woman, Lou Marr, who wrote this article, the half French Brit, she says, I cannot recall the French word for snack. I cannot recall the word because we don't snack in France. And so I never would have had to use that word. Is that possible? I don't understand. Oh,
God, like, is there anything worse than snacking elitism?
you snack, do you?
Look at me. I have self-control.
You American with your Nike sneakers.
Your inability to say no.
Feed me. You can't go 3 hours without being. Part of that, though, too, is because that's been drilled into our heads because that was the paradigm for a while. Remember,
right.
Now it's intermittent fasting, where just 10 years ago it was you have to eat 8 to 10 tiny meals per day. Keep your metabolism going constantly or you'll die.
Who would have thought like a country that's just built entirely on buying as much as humanly possible is telling you to eat more meals consistently.
This is interesting because she says, conveniently enough, the number three reason that the French people don't get fat, accidental intermittent fasting, because the French do not snack in the evening. You'd find that they accidentally practice intermittent fasting, which is intermittent fasting. It does annoy me a little bit that they basically make a big scientific deal out of like, oh, I skip breakfast.
Exactly. Eating less. Hey, who would have thought if you're eating fewer meals out of the day, you're going to lose weight. I'm like,
let me explain to you about your insulin sensitivity and everything. Like, no. Okay. I'm skipping
it's
a meal.
Rocket science. Right. Yeah. You mean they don't have a car and they walk everywhere nonstop all day and they don't eat breakfast.
Intermittent fasting works really well for me as long as I'm not exercising. Once I start exercising and try to get too hungry fast. Yeah. And I get angry. I get really angry. I flipped out on air a couple times last week and I pretty much tracked it. I was trying to figure it out. I was like, I'm not drinking. I'm not like, I'm getting enough sleep. What is going on? And I realized it was because I was still working out really hard but I was getting just kind of by happenstance, I was getting less than 100 grams of carbs per day. And I was consciously not eating breakfast, but I was also like not getting any carbs at all while still working out. And I just, I'll get to the point where I'm not hungry, but I'm angry. So I'm hangry without actually being hungry, which is just, I'm just angry.
Are you counting fibrous carbs in that, or is that just total?
That's just total. Yeah. The fiber. Mm. I do pretty well with fiber.
Yeah.
Sit down meals here in the UK. So she lives in the UK. We like to call dinner in front of the television, teas on knees. That's sexual almost.
Weird.
In all my years visiting France and having meals, I've never had a meal away from the table. So yeah, I mean, that stands.
Or next to a wall in the US, balls on walls is what we call that. You can cut that out.
I don't know what that means. I don't know.
Well, they're eating, sitting down. Tees on knees.
Whatever you're putting in your mouth, you're doing it at a table.
You're doing it wrong.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's a standard one that everybody knows, right? It's healthier if you actually prepare a meal, sit down. Not right. Being well distracted is a bad thing. That's one thing. That's one of the rules in our house is we're not allowed to just like be reading or watching television while you're munching on something.
Why is that? Is that because you eat more? Because
your body, you don't like kind of pay attention to the normal cues. So you just kind of, you power on through whatever your normal satiety, however you pronounce it. You're being sated. You kind of just bulldoze on through those because you're distracted. Whereas like when we try to practice mindfulness,
that's true.
Where you're actually enjoying the food and you're talking to people and everything.
I like that one. That's a good one. Cause that also just kind of helps with your general, that just makes you more congenial overall.
Yeah. Yeah. It keeps you off your phone. It just teaches you to just soak in life a little bit. We're all dying soon, Drew. Just absorb a little bit of this life.
Oh yeah. No, we are for sure.
Number five, they rarely eat fast food. I think that's changing. Yeah, but
I'm sure it is. There's no way we haven't infected the Western Europe yet with our. I'm certain of it. There's no doubt that percentage has to be going up.
It is interesting though that by almost worshiping food in a way that the French do, I think that they probably look down on fast food more than we do. Because they don't just worship, they worship well-prepared food in the whole process of it. So by worshiping food, they end up indulging less because they actually care about quality, not quantity. We've got 12 hours of work to do. We need to fuel ourselves. We're just going to shovel mass quantities in and get her done.
It's so true. I mean, this just sounds like the most like immediate post-college, I took a year off and went to Europe, take humanly possible. But if you spend like a significant amount of time, not just like in France, but kind of in that whole area, you can totally tell the difference. I mean, you can completely tell the difference.
Just the cultural difference.
The cultural difference.
Oh,
and
the
both, you know,
the food tastes.
Yeah. The food, yeah. it just tastes, there's not another word than it just tastes real. It doesn't taste like it's, you know, it's not fake.
They have much stricter, I believe, I'm going to generalize here, but I think most European countries have much stricter rules about additives and preservatives and all that. And I know a lot of people, I do think, I mean, there's some times where, like, I do think there are benefits to not eating gluten, even if you're not, you know, celiac or what have you. But I think in some people, people exaggerate it in their own minds because a lot of the glutinous food also tends to also have a lot of preservatives and artificial stuff in there. So I've noticed that with myself. I do feel less puffy and everything if I'm not eating glutinous stuff, but
Is it the gluten or is it because of all the other things that are like tied in? Yeah.
I think it's a little bit of gluten, but I think it's a whole lot the other stuff. And then especially if you're being strict and you fall off the wagon, you tend to like, okay, it's not just like I had some whole grain wheat bread. I ate like 18 donuts and it's not the gluten that's messing me up.
Yeah. It's the entire pizza I ate. That's full of 4 pounds of cheese too.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Like all the preservative. Yeah, completely. It's like the Atkins thing where I'm just like, I'm maybe there's science to that, but I think it's just that I didn't eat like 4 pounds of fries.
Well, I you know, I'm torn with the dairy part of it though too, because I've gone gluten and dairy free for the most part, which it's a nice way to keep yourself strict in general. If you're eliminating whole classes of foods, many of which are unhealthy, then you know, like cheese pizza's out, all that for the most part.
Exactly. Yeah, unless you're one of those people who eats nut cheese.
The thing with dairy, though, is that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because dairy, I mean, you do need certain bacteria in your gut to digest dairy. And if you don't have those, if they haven't been cultivated, then all of a sudden you throw a bunch of dairy into your gut. There's an adjustment period, you know.
Is that how that works? Does it go away and then you have to get it back? You ease back into it?
They come back really quickly. They repopulate very quickly. And I can't remember which actual strain of bacteria it is. But yeah, you're that's one of the part of your microbiome in your gut is the dairy. Now, obviously, other people have dairy allergies or they have issues with their microbiome and everything. But like in a normal person that doesn't typically have problems with dairy, you've got a certain level of bacteria in your gut that helps you digest it. If you go without dairy for like 6 months and then all of a sudden, you know, you drink a quart of cold milk or something, you're going to feel it the next day and it's going to be kind of ugly and stinky.
Yeah. You're going through the diarrhea phase.
Right.
And then, Yeah.
Did you ever do, when you were trying to gain weight back when you were a teenager, did you ever do a gallon of milk a day?
100%. Yes. Yeah. I did a gallon of milk a day. I will never forget when I was trying to weigh in at the combine. And my agent put in my head, for sure, he was like, look, you're big now because you're not big enough.
Yeah.
You got to weigh over 300 pounds. You got to. And I was like, really like 289 max. Like that was not my, you know, and I was like, all right. And he goes, this is what you're going to do. You're going to eat 2 large pizzas before you go to bed, get extra cheese, extra sauce, and then drink a gallon of Gatorade in the morning.
No.
And I was like, okay.
No.
So I did it. So I sat, and because Ryan Fitzpatrick, who was my roommate, was dead asleep because he's some kind of Harvard dork. I don't know if you know this, but he went to Harvard.
I heard that.
And
once,
yeah, I've read that several times every day forever. And I sat in the hallway at the hotel and ate 2 large pizzas, went back in, passed out, got up in the morning, drank a gallon of Gatorade.
Yeah.
And then didn't go to the bathroom at all.
Well, you held went it down, all that water.
Held it all in, went down, ate breakfast. And then went and we weighed in and I was so paranoid that I wasn't going to weigh enough. And I got in and I weighed 312.
Oh, you were just shooting for 300.
And then my colon exploded 10 minutes later.
Well, that's what I was going to say is he didn't have to tell you to eat all the pizza and everything. It's incredible how much water weight you can gain.
Yeah.
Like how much water you can force into your system. Even if you're peeing, it just, you can bloat right up. Like even if you would have taken some salt pills and drank a bunch of fluids or just drank Gatorade because it's salty to begin with, you could have gained a whole bunch. I definitely wouldn't have recommended the pizza because that's going to weigh you down.
I agree.
That was when, was the combine just 2 days, 3 days then? The workout was...
I think it was 3 days because I think...
You come in, you weigh in, you get there, you do some processing and meetings, and then the next day you weigh in and everything.
Yeah, you have like the full medical deal and then like interviews, and then you had like a couple of days of like testing, I think is how it worked. Yeah.
So, but if you do... If on that first night is when you're eating all the pizza and everything, you weigh in on day 2, you're still bloated.
It was horrible.
It was
not great. Yeah, it was not. It's not. I would not pass that on to other people.
I wonder if that was good or bad for you because you have a big frame. I know you're not tall, but you've got a big. You know, how tall are you? 6'4".
I'm 6'3", if we're being real.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you've got a big frame. Like I think scouts would have looked at you and thought, okay, well, you know, he'll gain 10 or 15 pounds.
I think there's no doubt that it helped me.
Oh,
now
so?
The really? The blowing out my pec at the combine didn't help me.
Yeah.
But the weight, I think people looked and they were shocked that I weighed that much for what I, cause my body fat was still only, it was like 19%.
Yeah.
Or like, like if you're below 20% and you're over, that's really lean for a
were they just using the bod pod at that point? Or were they doing calipers?
Truthfully, I can't remember how they did it.
Probably calipers.
It probably was.
Bod pod. Yeah. Very few linemen are below 20% when they use bod pod because that's.
But for an offensive lineman, it's hard to get below.
Yeah.
You know, and so I was like, they were like, look, this guy's like pretty well put together for a guy who weighs 312. Of course, they didn't know that I lost about 19 of that in an hour. But
I remember I had, I went through the combine with a partially torn patellar tendon that at the time we just thought was really bad tendonitis. I would find out later, like a year and a half later, that it was a partially torn patellar tendon, but I was disguising it from everybody.
Of course.
And I was in extreme pain. Like I thought if this is what tendonitis is, then I must be the biggest wimp on earth because this is dry. And I went through like the Cybex testing and everything.
Oh my gosh. Like, where it's just like only aggravating the exact thing.
Yeah. And I was lucky because my legs were so strong that even on my affected knee with the partially torn patellar tendon, it was a lot weaker than my other leg, but it was still way stronger than most people are with their legs. So like, it looked like they didn't think much of it. They just thought I had asymmetrical legs or something. Okay. Right. So this is another thing the French do. And this would be a dicey one in here in America. I don't think this is one I can even, I don't think I can even recommend this on this podcast without getting sued. Openly call out weight gain. Basically she's saying that.
I love that. I like that.
Well, I think what I've noticed about Europeans, to generalize again, like a few different people and going back to like exchange students in high school, I can remember this. I think non-Americans maybe in general are maybe a little bit more blunt about stuff sometimes.
Totally.
Like they're not so concerned with being, you know, like big, happy, smiley, friendly person. They'll just be like, oh, you've gotten fat.
They know their egos can withstand it. They're not going to go, you know. Taking antidepressants and then
they're not necessarily because they're not trying to bully you to death either. They're just kind of almost matter of factly saying like, oh, you've gotten fat.
Yeah. Yeah. Your buttons look like they're working twice as hard as they used to.
I wonder if that's, you know, in America, though, people are more and more comfortable with being thick with two C's. So I guess you gotta say you don't look thick. You just look doughy. Is what's happened to you here.
But that doesn't mean,
but it's not a compliment.
That's not an approval of like a double chin situation. That's a different kind of.
Yeah. Nobody's like, wow, you've got your waddle is thick.
No. Exactly. Like, oh, I definitely can't. There's no way you're wearing a tie.
I want to lose myself in that waddle. Yeah. Number seven, lunch is the biggest meal of the day.
Children, I can get behind that.
Children will come home from school for lunch and parents will work if their job permits. Parents come home from work if their job permits. Shops will close for an hour and have families sit around the dinner table for a large lunch. That's interesting. There's studies that show that can help your insulin sensitivity and correct circadian misalignment.
That makes perfect sense though, doesn't it? As opposed to like...
You probably sleep better too. And the quality sleep has been shown to reduce your appetite. And
you're not just like just absolutely obliterating a huge dinner right before you go lay down for eight or nine hours. You know, it's like that has to be. And plus like the big thing too is that they're also eating sweets. Like I feel like they like sweets more than a lot of
like pastries.
Not just
sweets, but like sweets with buttery, flaky, fatty stuff in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they're, you know, still skinnier.
Lunch is the biggest meal of the day was number seven. Number eight is food education in primary schools. I feel like we do that, don't we?
Yeah, we do it, except like it's like paid for and brought to you by Kraft. Like in the US, it's like Haribo is providing you the food pyramid, sour straws at the top, candy corn in the middle. You know,
they changed the food pyramid, and part of it was I watched this documentary a while back on the food pyramid, and I don't think it was even like a deep conspiracy theory or anything. Somebody fact check me on this, and I'll have to ask Roberta Anding about this, perhaps the dietitian. Roberta.
She's the best.
She's awesome. But like the food pyramid, I can remember learning just old school basic nutrition and looking at the food pyramid and thinking like, that doesn't seem to work right. Like, even then?
Yeah.
Yeah, because it was like a boatload of grains and everything.
Yeah.
And then like two or three servings of protein at the top. And I'm like, the grams don't work out right. Like,
the foundation was bread.
Yeah, it was like all lots bread. And lots of bread. It was almost like a picture of like you. What I needed to have was like a baguette with a couple little chicken breasts on top of it or something. Some of this doesn't make sense. And I think I want to say that at least part of it was that they have to and this is where public health always gets dicey. They're trying to figure out a way for it to be economical. Like the biggest blend between, okay, what can people afford versus what's actually ideal? Where I feel like sometimes, especially now that people have the internet and whatnot, I feel like you gotta shoot it straight with some people and just say, look, the ideal would be such and such. You probably can't afford that. So I don't know, have some canned beans or something instead. But
I think you're right. It was like they were trying to grapple with a booming population, right? And so they were like, oh, how are we gonna feed all these people?
Because it is
not all gonna go like, out and yeah.
Have you ever done an experiment where you just like try to figure out, okay, how cheap could I eat? Like if you go buy big bags of grains, you know, of various, whether it's oats or wheat or what have you, you can get quite a bunch of calories with not that much money, you know, like maybe a tub of margarine.
Yeah. I think what you're describing is how to live on just your scholarship check.
Is it? Yeah.
I did do an experiment like that. I did it for 4 years.
What was the cheapest you, what would you get your
dude? Okay. So one of the, I don't know if you ever noticed this, but, and I think this is still true, but one of the most bizarre, like economies of scale is the cost of eggs.
Yeah.
So like a dozen eggs is like $3.39 or whatever it is, you know, like on average. Five dozen eggs is like $4.20. I don't know why.
Especially
that
if
is.
You go to like a wholesale club and you get the big tower of eggs.
Yes.
It's like, so you, it's like four trays on top of each other.
Yeah, how can and then you get, not buy all three? I'm probably going to waste most of them, but it's so much cheaper. But
fried
you gotta
egg
do
sandwiches.
It.
That's where I always felt like fried egg sandwiches are the most bang for your buck because mayonnaise is relatively cheap. It's got some egg whites in there and you know, you get some cheap bread.
And cheap bread, Wonder Bread. You get like two loaves for like $3. Yeah.
Fry up a bunch of eggs and you got a bunch of calories and protein in there and a good amount of carbs too.
And ramen. You could just get like 400 packages of ramen.
I could never get into ramen. I always felt like it was, if it was processed like that, that it was going to, I never even looked at prices or anything.
Oh, I'm sure it's horrible for you, but it's so incredibly cheap. I mean, you can get that entire like 48 count, you know, box for like $3.
You're right about the eggs though, too, even though it was almost, it didn't make any sense not to buy the big tower of eggs.
No, you couldn't not do it.
You're going to waste half of them.
It was too cheap. You could not do it.
Why would they do that though? I wonder if we were buying old eggs too. Like, do they repackage them all like that? And they're trying to sell them to, they're like, okay, we got to get these moved out to the college kids.
It had to be. I have no, the same thing for yogurt. You could get a giant gallon thing of vanilla yogurt for, you know, like $2 or $3. If you got the individually packaged ones, they were seven times more expensive.
I'm going to look this up right now. How much for a gross of eggs?
A gross?
Price of a gross of eggs? 144 items, U.S. retail price. I don't know. This isn't going to work. But yeah, egg prices in the U.S. peaked in 2015 when a dozen eggs cost $2.75. That's not bad. I'm gonna tell Brandy today that we're going on an experiment. I'm gonna need to eat on $5 a day for as long as I can. I think you could do it. Yeah, I could, but I'll be grumpy.
You could definitely do it. It would be terrible for you, but you could do it.
Well, I don't have to do a lot of stuff that's terrible for me. It's the experiment. You do a 1 month experiment. Your body can handle that.
I like this. Should we just do a thing where it's like every month we do a new experiment?
Oh yeah, we could do that. Let's
just take are we taking suggestions or are we doing it on our own? We source it internally.
I could take suggestions. You know what we should do is just we'll assemble a list of kind of in vogue diets and exercise routines and everything, and just pick one out of a hat.
I'm into that. I would definitely do that. Okay. Yeah, we'll I'd be on top of the diet. I'd be on top of doing an experimental diet and or workout. The workout thing's tough because there's a lot of stuff I like literally can't do. But
yeah. Oh, you know what I could do? I'm going to send you, I started working on my cocktail of different things that I'm going to do for my joints. Cause I was tired of not being able to do like a few, like I was tired of not being able to just jog 200 yards when I need to jog 200 yards. Cause I've got meniscus issues. So I'm going to, before I get my knees replaced, I'm going to just try to make it as active and physical as possible using nothing but
nice,
good sneakers, lots of stretching and a boatload of different supplements. like hopefully non-Advil type supplement.
I love that. So I really want to see how that turns out because I'm right behind you.
There's a special Boswellia serrata extract that I'll have you take. There, a boatload of fish oil. There's one other thing. Oh, just CBD, a good CBD.
And I've this is great Joe Rogan content.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
this is pinnacle Rogan content.
Yeah, but this is the whole thing. This is the kind of stuff that the medical establishment isn't making any money off of.
They don't want you to know about this because because of the margins.
Yeah, I mean, I'm making money off of it, but the medical establishment isn't. So you got
who do you want to give your money? You want to support me or them? You know, it's like,
So all right, okay. Well, that'll be our plan next week. I'll have a regimen for you. Awesome. Oh, hey, good. We did also, just to keep you updated, we were going to try to keep this to a half hour. I think we're at about 50 minutes right now. So
nailed it. Yeah,
perfect. Why don't you go diet with your words next
time? Hey, I have had multiple people tell me, you know what? I bet, why did they get shorter? I like when they're longer. Yeah, I have.
I find that usually, I've noticed this when I interview people, usually the first 20 minutes is like the part that I find the most boring. And then as soon as you say like, okay, that's about it, all of a sudden you end up having like 20 minutes of really interesting conversation. It's like, it's somehow like that's when the barriers break down.
Totally.
It's probably like, I don't know. They probably recommend 20 minutes of foreplay or something in sex, but who's got time for that? But if you did, it would probably be really good.
Theoretically.
And no, everybody knows that we know what we're talking about with that stuff. Cause we did that,
I've had sex.
No, we did that. What was that clitoris thing we did? You and I.
Are you doing the hand motion on purpose? I wish podcasting was more of a visual medium. Because you're literally doing like a kind of a fig.
A clockwise motion with my finger.
Everyone knows you spell the alphabet. Everyone knows that.
Remember that thing about the female orgasm cult?
I was just talking about the female orgasm cult yesterday with somebody. I was just recapping with my financial advisor.
How do you talk somebody into going to the female orgasm cult?
I don't know. I was going through my junk drawer looking for flyers.
I'm still not convinced. You know what? I forgot about that female orgasm cult. I'm still not convinced it's not just like a way for guys to try
that is what it is. Yeah, that is like, exactly what it is.
That like they've got this whole they figured out layers of an organization to try to figure out a way to, you know,
for prostitution,
to finger women, for cash
or whatever that is. Yeah,
I don't know. Yeah, it was kind of. I don't think there was actual penetration or anything, but
fingering is penetration.
Yeah, but I don't think they fingered.
I know that that's penetration. Well, you mean like legal,
No, I think they were just all about clitoral stimulation, like what they're doing at that female orgasm cult. It was focused like laser in on like the one.
Where's the clit? Oh man!
I thought they were focused on like the top left quadrant. Wait, are you saying it's in front of the butthole?
it's not even. Oh,
all right, that's it. We gotta go. That's enough.
Okay,
this is a PG podcast. Damn it.
Sorry.
All right, buddy.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
For those in recovery, support from friends and family often leads to better outcomes. Here's to those who are essential to helping people find their path to recovery. Visit cdc.gov/stopoverdose for information about treatment options and how to support those experiencing addiction.
Trying to figure out what to eat for dinner yet again? With Norsides and bouillon as your not-so-secret ingredient, you can skip the drive-thru and do dinner at home. Nor Taste Combos provide a menu of delicious, affordable, and well-balanced meals that you can prepare in 30 minutes or less. Visit nor.com to get quick and easy recipe ideas for your home-cooked weeknight dinners. It's not fast food, but it's so good.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly! Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm John Oran, and I have a new podcast called The Varsity. I will bring on the smartest people I know to break down the hottest topics in sports media. Available now on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.